Welcome to the show. Now, today I have two very special guests, and that is Paul and Rollo, and these guys are from Antelope Hill Publishing. I think a lot of people listening to this will be familiar with those people by now, and they have some fantastic releases. But how would you guys like to introduce yourself before we get into what you've been publishing?
Well, I'm Paul, by the way. I think that the most important thing that we're doing here is basically, you know, functioning as a business, you know, more important than I think any of the content. And we'll get into the content a little bit. We've got some really great stuff. Rollo will talk a little bit about, he's the translator for the original translation of Burning Souls that we put out. So, you know, and then we'll talk a little bit about Transgender Industrial Complex, which I'm sure many people have heard of, that actually just as of this morning was banned off Amazon. So that's an exclusive sneak peek you get here. Yeah. But
it actually lasted longer than we probably assumed that it would.
but I mean, for anyone who isn't familiar, I guess, to just, you know, we are a pro-white publishing company, one of many. We are in on good relations with Imperium Press and a handful of the other publishers that are working through you know, some old literature that they're republishing, and as well as some new stuff by our guys. We are pro-white, and we make no bones about that. We do consider it a part of the mission of the company to do what we can as an economic vessel, and you know, a social vessel to better the cause of you know, white people in the United States against a hostile government, and as well as, you know, corporate structure. Obviously, people may have noticed that the Amazon is not too friendly towards books that have important things to say in them. So, you know, we thought there would be room for some facilitation of access to either books that are out of print or books that would be quickly banned from Amazon. Like, for example, the one that we, our first original release by Scott Howard, The Transgender Industrial Complex, obviously did not last too long on Amazon. So yeah, we're trying to get access to cultural works as well as intellectual works of significance that you can't do elsewhere, as well as function a functioning business enterprise for our guys.
Yeah, I mean, what made you I remember you tweeted before the Antelope Hill Publishing Twitter account, tweeted before the many sort of pro-white or vaguely sort of distant right-leaning publishers there are now. There's actually more than I thought when you add them all up together. You know, there's Ertos and Washington Summit and Imperium Press, as you mentioned, and yourselves and a few others. So yeah, I mean, you know, what made you think that publishing was the route to go when you see some of those formidable competitors, if you can call them that, or is how much of this is kind of a labor of love?
Well, it is a little bit of a labor of love, yeah. This is something that I think, wanted to do, a lot of us. It's also something that we knew we had the skill set for, and so I think there was somewhat of a sense that we owed it both to ourselves and to other people who would benefit from it to actually get out there, do a competent job, open up something that would have some impact. So yeah.
Yeah, it's these, some of them were things that we individually had a lot of care about. Others were just things we got recommended from other people. Obviously, we're not republishing anything that the other publishers are publishing. So, you know, it's not really like we're stepping on toes or anything like that. And we've tried to maintain and develop good relationships with the other publishers. We Imperium Press and Rogue Scholar, we bought some large orders of their books and have been selling them, you know, on their behalf at some events that we've been to, and as well as on our website. So, you know, it's definitely mutual economic benefit of you know, people that have a common goal that we're trying to foster and participate in, as far as specifically the books, that's kind of just, you know, our guys like books, you know, it's whether they read or don't, you know, it's, you know, so I'm guilty of it too.
I purely prestige items. Yeah. People love to buy them.
Yeah. People like books, especially banned books. Like, you know, that's like one of the things that, you know, it's our little like jab against, you know, a force that would have us be not just ignorant, but, you know, also sort of dumbfounded by the obscurity and difficulty in relating with massive enterprises like Amazon, which take over and, you know, monopolize access to basic information. And, you know, there's something even on the consumer side of sort of rebelling against that we all enjoy, and we know others, you know, definitely enjoy. So we wanted to be able to be a part of facilitating access to these titles that, you know, bad thinky.
Yeah, and I should say, like, you know, I use the word competition, but I really think it actually doesn't work like that with the book publishers, because, you know, I find when you start, you know, when you kind of get in the habit of buying books sort of within our own sphere, that it tends to be one of those things you start wanting to collect them and you start buying between the publishers. So that's a good thing. But I mean, like, what was it like? I mean, what's the process for getting deplatformed from Amazon? Because I was on Amazon the other day. I was picking up a couple of books. I know, shame on me for shopping there. But I was actually kind of surprised at some of the stuff that was suggested. Like, I don't know, I kind of assumed that they'd be even worse. Like, you know, there was a lot of stuff about, like, vaccines don't work and all this kind of stuff. And I don't know, some of the stuff I've heard from Amazon, it sounds like they're pretty bad for deplatforming. So I'm assuming maybe it's this only applies to pro-white books that they take off there.
Well, I think actually, I think there's actually a fair selection of pro-white literature. What they seem to be focusing on, at least from my anecdotal experience, is anything addressing content, like, for example, anything addressing basically gay, rainbow, trans, LGBT stuff, as well as anything addressing, you know, our tribal friends, shall we say.
Yeah, just real quick, actually, E. Michael Jones, I think, was pretty much completely deplatformed off Amazon. Like, yeah, I think they got rid of all of his works.
And, you know, he might be the first one
that did that. So that would fit in with that pattern already.
Yeah, and the transgender industrial complex was definitely a little bit of both, as it were.
Yeah, that's been my perception as well, that they are very sensitive to anything related to, yeah, like the Rainbow Coalition, mm-hmm. for short.
Yeah, so I think it may just be, I think it's an optics thing on their side, if I'm speculating, that it's a lot, you know, I think Amazon is very, very conscious of the fact that they hold a big monopoly, and especially based in the United States, which, you know, however distant that was, the U.S. does not have a good, you know, relationship with monopolies. And you know, people do still have a bad taste in their mouth about that concept. So I think that's they actually do sort of have to wage their own, like, optics battle to try and limit the targeting of their censorship to things that are, I guess, from their perspective, easily defensible, like, you know, like I said, the LGBT stuff, as well as the Jew stuff, that has a lot of money and a lot of power behind it. Whereas, you know, just simply pro-white stuff and that doesn't address either of those two topics can, you know, potentially foster a little bit of popular resentment that things like, you know, JQ and the LGBT stuff maybe wouldn't. That's just my speculation, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's your impression been in terms of the broader response from the nationalist community since you launched? I mean, you mentioned it before you came on here, but, you know, you've probably been mentioned on every TRS podcast. And I think it is probably at a stage where, like, everyone sort of in whatever we're calling it, the distant right sphere or whatever, has probably encountered your work by now. So, I mean, has that kind of exceeded your expectations, or?
Yes.
Yeah, we've been blown away by the level of support, you know, both through just people putting our name out there and also the amount of orders that we get, you know, especially after our name gets mentioned on one of the bigger podcasts. We'll see you know, a spike in orders. So
yeah, my myself, Rolo, and my wife Maggie, who's the chief editor, have basically been working overtime, fulfilling orders for the last week, and like we're making headway. We're not caught up by any reasonable stretch of the imagination. But since the, you know, handful of titles that we released for sort of our Christmas, you know, pre-Christmas edition, as well as the Transgender Industrial Complex, it's been an absolute unimaginable flood of, you know.
Yeah, struggling to actually get this stuff to people before Christmas, which we promised, and we've been in a bit of a mad scramble.
Yeah.
Well, so. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, people always, probably the most common question that I encounter is people saying, like, well, what can we actually do? Like, what can we do apart from talking, apart from, you know, this endless cycle of sort of give and takes on the news or whatever. But you do, I mean, you do see people are willing to support something. Like, I don't know if you guys saw, but Laura Towler, who's the deputy leader of Patriotic Alternative, launched her own tea brand after Yorkshire Tea basically said that they didn't want her as a customer. And, you know, she sold out, she completely sold out all their stock within a few hours of launching, and then got in more stock recently and sold that out again. So, I mean, you know, I think people do want to keep the money within the community, so to speak. They want to support pro-white businesses, and you know, book publishing seems to be the most obvious route to go down with that, you know, apart from you know, just merchandise that people are buying just to support content creators or whatever. But you know, I think that's there's a certain reason to be optimistic there, that, you know, when you do offer people an alternative, that people are willing to support it.
Absolutely. The, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit. But I think that is absolutely key. Basically just what you said there. I mean, we have a, you know, I mean, everybody was, well, most of us were sort of on the Trump train, or at least, you know, like sympathizing to various different populists. And one of the big, you know, topics with regard to that is like national sort of tariffs. And you know, favoring national production and industry over international production as a means of you know, encouraging all kinds of positive benefits. But I think what we need to conceive of is the fact that, you know, I mean, people have said this, but to really operate under the assumption, or the, you know, understanding that we are a nation within a nation, right? You know, even just as whatever dissident right wingers, we are sort of our own nation, attempting to appeal to a broader related nation, I think, but that we can exercise those kind, you know, maybe not conceive of them as tariffs, but sort of like the spirit of buy American, you know, hire American, like buy dissident right, hire dissident right. Like, I think that's definitely got to be something that we do moving forward if we want to build an anti-fragile parallel sort of social structure that we can actually use as a base of support to compete against you know, various different corporate and governmental structures that are designed to attack us.
And having the ability, as you said, to hire, I mean, that's the next step. Because for us at this point, we are mostly working on sort of an ad hoc volunteer basis. We are giving our time and our efforts where we can to have things succeed. You know, it's not formalized to the point of being, you know, like a more typical business yet. But as that emerges, as, you know, people create economic power within our sphere of things, we do gain the ability to actually support our own people. That's a very crucial thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we do have, you know, Rolo said it's most of the, I want to say like the heavy lifting or whatever is done by us more or less for free. Although, you know, we are progressing with the goal of establishing basically a consistent sustainable business model for this thing. And we're progressing a lot faster than we thought we would towards being able to basically support, if not full time, at least justified time for a handful of people working on this project. And we're also able to, like, we are paying translators, we are paying editors, and my wife included. We are paying authors, obviously, you know, Scott Howard's, you know, doing I think we were trying to, like, keep it under a certain point, a certain dollar value within the 2020 year for some tax implications, and, like, that's just completely blown out of the water. Like, there's no way we can
sold way too much.
Yeah,
for
we literally can't. It's like we're at the point where we are facing the fact that, like, we're going to actually have to pay taxes within our first year as a company, as a corporate entity, which is, like, is kind of unheard of. Normally you have so many startup costs and consumptive, like, costs when you start a business that very few businesses are actually successful to the level that they have to do that. But it's definitely something that we need to give back. Like we're not doing this to, certainly don't even come close to justifying the time that we spend, but we want to be able to at some point, maybe hand off is the wrong way of putting it, but we want to be able to bring more people into this and to expand the network at the same time and build and foster a whole business atmosphere of companies and enterprises that are, you know, fostering fluidity and ease of commerce between each other so that we can seriously start to you know, create, like Rollo said, employment for our guys to be able to, like, keep, as you said, money within this thing and like support each other. What we actually have, we were hanging out with another guy from one of the groups that we're involved with, and he was saying, like, you know, like he was thinking the other day, like, why isn't every bar of soap I have, why isn't that Mighty White Soap Co.? Like, why am I still buying soap from the grocery store or Walmart or whatever? And, like, that's sort of like the ideal, right? Is if we can be a part of facilitating to make sure that, you know, you don't have a good reason to say no. You don't have a good reason to say, you know, it's easier or it's more effective, that it's right there for people to be able to support and to foster the kind of you know, true, like, economic stability and sufficiency that we will need in the future to come.
Yeah, if we can turn every transaction or most of the transactions we make in our daily lives as people in this sphere into transactions that support other members, that's the kernel of political independence.
Yeah, I mean, like, every dollar that you don't spend on Amazon, even if you get less for it, is a dollar that's not going to Zog. Like, you know, same thing is true of you know, it, like, every other massive service and massive corporation you can think of, you know. So every dollar counts, in my view. Like, every dollar that you're not sending to a bank or to a, you know, a major corporate gay rainbow corporate coalition kind of institution is a win. And it's, you know, people want to, as we've seen, they want to more than we ever thought they could. It's just, it's up to people like us and others to step up to the plate and really sort of get that kind of stuff going. We have some projects, but before we get too far afield, I did want to, like, just at least briefly go over the titles that we have, just in case any of them strike anyone, particular interest, like, really, and they want to, you know, take a look at them. So, as I mentioned, Rollo was responsible for translating Burning Souls. Do you want to give a quick intro of that?
Yes. So the Burning Souls was a post-war memoir written by Léon de Grelle, who's a very famous Belgian political figure and soldier in the Second World War.
I've got a copy of the Burning Souls right next to me here, just arrived today. I'm really happy with this so far. I'm really surprised that how good of a writer de Grelle is. I mean, I only read a couple of things by him before that was more politically focused. But I mean, yeah, I mean, it's credit to you for the translation, because it really translates well. I mean, some of it is so poetic. It's yeah, it's quite something.
Yeah, you're definitely right, though. I have to give DeGrell credit as a writer. It was a pleasure to translate this, and it flows very naturally, even in the translation. I'm no virtuoso with this type of thing, so really a lot of it is down to how well written, how beautiful the original was. But right, like I was saying, so DeGrell fought in the Second World War. He was a Belgian. He joined up on the German side after the invasion of the Soviet Union. He was in the Wehrmacht, later the SS, fought in a lot of the great battles on the Eastern Front. And basically, he managed to get out at the end of the war. He managed to flee first to Denmark and then to Spain. Lived until quite an old age. I believe he survived until around 1980. And this is one of the writings that he made in exile. It's very beautiful. It covers a lot of the things he viewed as important about his own life, kind of his reflections, the meaning he found in his experiences, all that sort of thing. It's very sad. It's also very encouraging. It's very positive as well.
Yeah. That one's a big, definitely one of the more, I think, in my mind, important cultural artifacts that we can bring to an English speaking audience. And that's something that I'm really proud to, have been even a tangential part of. And like you said, Rollo did an excellent job with that. Next one that we have is, these are in no particular order. They're literally, I just grabbed a bunch of them from the stack that we have. We have Arthur Loveday's History of the Spanish Civil War, Spain, 1923 to 1948, Civil War and World War, which is kind of a sort of forgotten epoch a lot of times in the history of Europe in the early 20th century. So that's definitely interesting for anyone who's interested in learning a little bit more about that epoch. Then we have An Outlaw's Diary, which is actually the second, not volume, it's the Cecil Torme was, or Cecile, I don't know.
Cecile.
Was it Hungary, right?
Yeah, she was Hungarian.
She was like a dissident in Hungary during the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yeah, again, and, a very overlooked part of history.
Right.
Bela Kun's Red Revolution in Hungary in 1919. It was every bit as bloody and deranged as the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, although mercifully shorter lived.
Yeah. So this was after the earlier sort of political revolution. This was this she had a diary for sort of, I don't want to say peaceful, but the more, subtle period in history. And that was just before much more bloody takeover by the sort of Soviet-backed
yes,
people.
Again, quite similar to the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia itself. Began with basically a coalition of social democrats who were more moderate and looking more towards stability. And then the Red Revolutionaries who came along and toppled the whole thing.
So, An Outlaw's Diary is her firsthand account of basically fleeing through the country during all of those the much more violent period of that history. Then, of course, we have the infamous now Transgender Industrial Complex, which is a look through the financial and NGO backers as well as the individuals that are sort of pulling the strings behind all of those dollars, millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars, and and all those governmental organizations and non-governmental organizations, as well as relationships with public schools and drag queen story hours and stuff like that. So this
one blew me away when I saw it. I mean, not to intimidate anyone, you should definitely still buy this and read it. It is 430 pages of original research and explanation. I mean, this is really impressive.
Yeah, Scott Howard did an absolutely amazing job. This is his first book. he approached us when he heard about us and said, I want to send this to you guys. And we were like, wow.
Yeah. I'm glad that he did.
Yeah. This is an amazing piece of work. And it's just one of those things. I think it's going to go down as, like, you know, possibly the LGBT version of Culture of Critique. Like, it is such a devastating takedown of what is often presented as this, like, you know, grassroots. Oh, you know, you're like, if you attack LGBT stuff, you're like kicking a puppy or something. It's like, no, that is a system and a network of very motivated and very ideologically driven people with an agenda that they are pushing top down.
And to no one's surprise, if you go to, like, the appendix of people's names who were involved in this, it reads like a Tel Aviv phone book.
Yeah. It literally does have an
appendix with names in it of prominent, like, this. It's actually in here. The Tel Aviv phone book is, like, the last several pages.
One of the appendix A.
Yeah, I'd like to get into that a bit more later. But yeah, I mean, I remember doing research on, like, what started this whole transgender craze. And yeah, I mean, it's what's interesting as well is, like, it's these people like Jennifer Pritzker and these people, but they're all, like, they're very strange sort of intellectual interests as well. Like, they're all into transhumanism and weird sort of anarchist, like, intellectual currents.
Well, I mean, they're fundamentally, in my humble opinion, they are anti-human, and so they will associate themselves with whatever, you know, seemingly piecemeal set of seemingly unrelated ideas and movements, all through the service of elevating themselves by denigrating the world around them. I think that's a definite common theme.
They're all bizarre Gnostic heresies at root.
Yeah. moving on, we'll definitely get revisit that and talk a little bit more. I think that stack's gonna fall. We have BUF, an internal history of the British Union of Fascists. Like I said, internal history. So this was written by a member, citing a lot of Mosley's speeches, I believe, is a lot of the content of it.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of tying them together along with some of the events that were transpiring during the course of the narrative that it's covering, sort of discussing the rise and some of the struggles and
it's mostly a study of Mosley himself and his ideas and then secondarily the things that happened around him and the political events that concerned him.
So that is definitely worth checking out if you're interested in the Anglo's idea of fascism.
If you're interested in the non-Anglo idea of fascism, we have the Patrick Pierce here.
I don't know why those two didn't catch on fire they're next to each other.
Yeah.
We have the collected writings of, or collected work, sorry, of Patrick Pierce, which you probably know more about than we do as simple American
I'm
folk.
Sure.
but it is corrected collected work of some of Patrick Pierce's essays and poetic writings that I can't imagine anyone listening to your show is not aware of who Patrick Pierce is, but just in case, he was one of the members of the Easter Rising. And he was executed after the Easter Rising.
Yep, in 1916. It happened during the First World War, yes.
Wow. That's how much I know, but it's definitely some interesting stuff. His philosophy of education and other stuff is you don't have to just be an Irish nationalist to.
It's quite relevant. Yeah. I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think he's in general underrated as kind of an early philosopher of nationalism, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So then we have, and before I forget, though, I did want to mention, we have one of the more recent things that we actually sold out of just yesterday is the, when I say sold out of, meaning we fulfilled as many orders as we have books, and so more on the way. The Wehrmacht Fitness Manual, which a lot of people were very excited about, as we could tell by how quickly it sold out, the it was a sort of a internet Spurg sourced translation from the original Wehrmacht like exercise and, you know, like fitness manual for it. Has a lot of like activities and sort of physically oriented games.
It was the physical instruction manual for the army. It was a manual from the 1930s that they put out when they were, you know, re-expanding the here.
So it has all the original like images and diagrams and stuff of like how to do these exercises and activities.
And it's quite aesthetic, honestly. Even if I was never going to use it for those purposes, I would like to have it just because of the illustrations and the typeface. It's all very 1930s. Looks very good.
And we cannot take credit for translating it or really producing that. We kind of just printed it, but
that was all courtesy.
No, it's never been printed before, so yes. As far as we're aware, this is the only physical copy of that.
The PDF version that we took it from for the printing job was done by the so-called Bureau of Mimetic Warfare. So credit to them for that.
So that's definitely a special one. We didn't actually say this one yet. One of my favorites is Wyndham Lewis's Hitler, which is an interesting account by kind of an oddball cultural figure in English history. Wyndham Lewis is sometimes known as an author, but he's probably best known as the painter and founder of Vorticism. I believe he is the only Englishman to be credited with founding a movement in visual art. It's a modern art variation similar to Cubism,
I believe Borzoi did the introduction for that.
I wasn't going to forget that. That's this is But the book is about Wyndham Lewis's journey to Hitler during, I think, 1930. It's somewhat satirical, but it's quite clear that he has a deep respect for what the National Socialists were doing in Germany in the early 1930s, and he did not that didn't go over too well in his circles. Let it be, you know, as you can imagine, when he returned to England,
fairly bohemian company, his personality, and
He endeavored to sort of try and restore his good name after that, but never really quite succeeded in living this book down. But the content of the book speaks for itself. It is absolutely it's funny, it's witty, and it's also, you know, it clearly shows that you didn't have to be German. You didn't have to be under the suspense of the hypnotic gaze of Hitler to appreciate what the National Socialists were achieving as a social phenomena in Germany. And of course, as you said, with a foreword by John Chapman, which is better known as Borzoi Boscovich. I very, very much enjoy Borzoi's foreword. It's quite excellent, actually. I'm going to read the
wittiness of it. Really fits with the rest of it as well.
Yes, Borzoi was the right man for the job for this one. I'm going to read the last paragraph of Borzoi's foreword. Hitler is not going anywhere. This is his world, and we're all just living in it, whether his followers win or fail. As the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard scribbled down in his journals, the tyrant dies and his rule is over. The martyr dies and his rule begins. In Hitler's case, it might be said to be both. And I think that is an absolutely, you know, beautiful way of describing sort of, what we're all living through right now and sort of, you know, even in a microcosm as a part of what we're trying to do. So definitely an interesting work I would check out if you're a fan of either Borzoi or you know, our uncle.
It's all Hitler's world. Always has been.
Yeah, always has been. The beginning part definitely does a good job too. Borzoi describes, like, you know, one imagines that, like, Hitler would, you know, if he didn't exist, we'd have to create him.
The humorous anecdote about everyone who says they would go back in time and kill baby Hitler.
Yeah.
Maybe they'd hesitate if they realized it would destroy their entire world as they know it.
Yeah, exactly. And, the idea of Hitler is like the Atlas, you know, holding up the progressive modern world, I think is definitely an apt description. So then we have some original translations of Carl Schmitt's work.
Yep, we have C.J. Miller's translation.
Yeah, C.J. Miller's.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking here at the at your sort of shop front on your website, and yeah, what does stand out? 4 out of the 12 books are by Carl Schmitt. So is that a reflection of your own sort of love of Schmitt, or is that more of a response?
Well, it's slightly misleading. I suppose because the goal from the beginning was to translate those three sort of collections of essays and speeches as they had been previously published as individual books, but to collect them together in this final work, which is the combined set of all three of those works that we offer individually. So it is what's the order? I just want to read the exact order. I would just on there.
Oh, political theology, theory of the partisan, and concept of the political. And so we have those for sale on the website as three standalones. They are fairly small, lower price than most of our other stuff. And then the Sovereign Collection is the three of those together. I think we're only doing hardcovers for this, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's a nice copy of something that will last a long time and has. It's called the Sovereign Collection because sort of the common theme is the sort of concept of the sovereign and the people's relationship to it. And
Schmitt is a theorist of state power, if nothing else.
Obviously, someone who was the former chief jurist in the National Socialist government, Germany, he is not treated kindly by modern academia. And
yet, it is a testament to his,
absolutely.
His endurance as a prominent thinker that he is still widely cited in the academic world. And there are indeed some people in academia who will treat him favorably despite his connections.
He is to political science as Nietzsche is to philosophy.
Yes.
His ideas are very, very anti-liberal, but he was too tempting and too good. And his content was too, full to be ignored. So what they kind of tried to do is water it down with various different, footnotes and translations and stuff like that. So we're trying to avoid that and produce an honest to the original content translation, this release of these works.
Well, I mean, supposedly Schmitt has taken on a life of his own in China. I don't know if you've heard about that, but supposedly,
We haven't shifted books to China yet.
So, modern Chinese political thought is mostly Schmitt and Strauss, from what I hear.
That doesn't surprise me.
I've heard that as well.
So I think that's is that everything?
Yeah, that's our whole collection at this point. We're probably fairly soon going to have too many to list them off all at once.
Yeah. But,
I mean, what's your selection process in terms of original content versus things you're republishing? I mean, I know the Transgender Industrial Complex is your first original work, but I mean, what's the plan for that going forward?
So I actually think, not to get anyone too excited, but I think Scott Howard actually just recently sent us another book. I don't know if he wrote it since this one or what, but he seems to be a rather prolific author. I actually forget what that one's about, so you'll have to stay tuned. But we are basically evaluating more or less anything that comes our way. Can't promise we'll accept whatever it is, but if you've, it's not like we're trying to stick to some line. It's got to be, it's got to be something that more or less has a reason to be published by us rather than any other publisher. But that reason can be wide ranging.
And I do want to put out there,
would you publish any fiction?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've received quite a few submissions. One of the things I would just want to put out there though, for, anyone who might be thinking about that, we do not have the time to do copy editing, and that's been one of the major problems with some of the submissions we've had so far, is that they just we have submissions where the punctuation is just not good, that's very difficult for us to do time wise.
Yeah, in fairness, is a lot of people submitting things are not professional authors, and they have their own work lives and stuff like that, but it is. We do try to work with authors that we have to we're not just going to, like, you know, we're not some, like, mass, you know, market McPublishing company that's just going to take your thing, run it through spell check, and then, you know, stick it through our automated formatting thing by right. Pajit Diversity Hire and
just,
you know,
anyone that's listening, just don't send them anything unless it's really good. Don't send them shit. Well, okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's just going to take a lot more time. If you know, if it's worth, we have a large backlog, so, you know, you're not going to cut any space in line by sending it to us sooner. Honestly, you know, just, you know, revisit it, reread it, have friends, family, or, you know, other, you know, acquaintances in the movement read it, and you know, definitely have get other people's opinions, and then, you know, if we don't think it's fit to publishing, we'll usually give you some sort of response to help improve your writing, and maybe another work or that work to resubmit, but that doesn't happen very, very often. And, you know, it is still, you know, we are looking for new work. We do have enough for the foreseeable future, but, you know, eventually we're going to, you know, we're going to need more work. We can't exhaust, you know, there's only so much banned sort of out of print historical literature. So we're going to definitely in the future need work. So, you know, maybe it doesn't get published in the next couple months, but you know.
And I know there are people out there in our thing who can write and should be writing things, because I've seen the amount of effort they'll put into, you know, Twitter threads.
Yeah.
You know, 20 posts tied together. Like, bro, write a book.
Yeah. Speaking of that, we do have some exciting names. I believe we will be having a... I don't think this is any sort of scoop, because if you follow him, you probably have noticed he's mentioned before, but Borzoi's working on a book in coming months be hopefully bringing to the public of his existing writings that he's published, and also perhaps some new stuff. That I think will be very popular.
Are we mentioning the coffee table book yet?
Oh, yes, because no, it's not, because
okay. Yeah,
because
just quickly on... Quickly on Borza, I remember he did an article like maybe a year ago for the American Sun. What was it? The Feasts of Shame or something. It was it was a really, really well written article. But yeah, it was like 24,000 words. It's like, you know, dude, you could have just like added an introduction and made this a book, you know.
that was one of the things that I thought of. I gotta say, I was the one who approached him about that. You know, I literally was like, all right. So let's take everything that he's got on race boars and then this article, and how many words do we have? Like, is this enough for a book? And it was almost there. So I'm like, hey, can we put this stuff together? And he's like, I want to write some more stuff too. So
the book he has coming is, you know, it's totally original. It's not a collection of writings.
Oh no, it is. I'm saying, like, he will have some original work on there, and you know, maybe in the future it'll be, you know, all original work. But this first one, at least by Borzoi, will contain the various different essays and stuff that he's already published, as well as, like I said, some new work.
That'll be great. He's a good writer.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that's not going to be the last thing that he publishes, and hopefully it won't be the last thing he publishes with us. As far as other works that we have coming down the pike, can you think of anything that sticks out off the top of your head?
I think you were about to spill the beans on a coffee table book.
That's right. Yes, yeah, there's a very special coffee table book.
We have coming a coffee table book that'll be all of the cover artwork from Fash the Nation.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so Jazz Hands is McFeels himself is one who I believe approached us about this, he's very excited about it, and so are we. It'll be our first foray into the colored media print, but I think people will buy it as a novelty. I mean, some of those covers have quite a lot of effort attention put into detail. Them and a lot of details, so they're definitely worth something, and there was even talk about making this like a recurring thing, like every year publish a book of the FTN cover art, because they have two a week for, you know, 50 weeks, so that's an exciting new thing.